Contented Media presents Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, an original podcast series with Mark Hunter and Arthur Van Pelt.
Hello and welcome to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, and the third of our unscripted, unedited, and largely unfunny recaps of the Cooper versus Wright trial. This week we saw witnesses from both sides take the stand before Craig Wright returned, watermarked white paper in hand, to answer questions over his 11th hour evidence that Christian Agerhansson planted on his machines. We'll get to that. With me to dissect this week's action is the man who can do 2 million transactions per second all on his own. It's Arthur Van Pelt. Arthur, how does this week compare to the last two for you?
Oh, this was, for me, a quite interesting week. Not so much the witnesses that has been, the witnesses from Craig Wright's side, but I found the Wednesday very interesting. Because that's when I just published an article, a pretty long article about it today, which is going viral. You have no idea I just published it 3, maybe 4 hours ago, and I'm already on more readers than my last two articles together in their lifetime. So it's crazy.
Wow.
Crazy. Yeah, it's because it's about what I call the OGs of Bitcoin OGs, Adam Back and Marty Malmy. They were on the stand for a cross-examination on Wednesday. Yeah, and they had so much to say, and their witness statements, who became available also, I think, the same day or the next day, but rather pretty quickly afterwards. So I could also use their witness statements and see what they were debunking in Craig Wright's statements, in his witness statements, and what he said on the stand. I could beautifully compare all that material. And of course, on Friday, which was also a beautiful day, we saw also a few unique things, among them a time-lapse demonstration of how Craig Wright has been creating the LaTeX forgeries. So yeah, that was beautiful, beautiful stuff. So for me, the highlights were Wednesday and Friday.
Cool. Well, we're going to do things in reverse order. We're going to start with Craig Wright's testimony from Friday, and we'll then tackle what the witnesses had to say in the second half. So Craig Wright came back onto the stand on Friday, and he came with huge expectations as far as the BSV community was concerned. They seemed to be expecting the revelation of where the watermark is in the Bitcoin white paper. They seemed to be expecting some bombshell evidence that was going to wipe the floor with whatever Cooper had so far. And there's even suggestions going back to weeks and months before the trial even started that he was going to sign one of Satoshi's blocks in court. And it's interesting because you get a flavor of the kind of thing that the BSV crowd were expecting, when, just to quote a couple of bits from social media that I saw, just to really frame what they were anticipating from this day. Someone said in the lead up to Friday, "I can't wait for Craig to show what text he hid using Snow," which is a watermarking tool, I believe, "and to recreate it at home with his instructions." And someone else said, "BTC troll will dream of another false narrative after the watermark, but they will fail this time. The world will know that Craig is Satoshi." And then someone else replied and said, "That watermark he's promised will be incontrovertible proof. Checkmate BTC trolls." Now, Arthur, what was the actual reason why Craig Wright was coming back to the stand?
Yeah, the actual reason was that the last minute evidence, which was again a bunch of forgeries, of course, the latest bunch of evidence that he delivered was a few days before the trial started on February the 5th. And in the beginning of this trial, I think it was decided on February the 5th, on the first day, or maybe the second day, but I don't remember exactly anymore. But it was decided and ruled by the by Justice Meller that Team Copa would get 2 weeks time to inquire that new evidence and create a new Madden forensic report about it, and then after 2 weeks they would exchange that information with Craig's team, and then they would take another week to get Craig right back on the stand for a cross-examination about his latest evidence. And there was no room for anything else, so there was no bombshell evidence moment planned. There was not anything with watermarks planned. That was just something that Craig Wright mentioned in a witness statement and mentioned in court, without giving any evidence of that stuff. And we will learn in a bit that there is no watermark.
So the first thing that was tackled was the MYOB data. Now, this was a set of accounting records purporting to show entries from the 2009 to 2011 era involving, I think, Wright International Investments and some alleged Bitcoin holdings that were brought to light in the Tulip Trading case and then crossed over to the Copa case when their importance was revealed. Now, the interesting thing that was discovered during the analysis of these documents was that the data, the specific data relating back to this era, was inputted into the system on March the 6th to 7th, 2020, 3 days before the entire thing was handed over to Ontier, who were in charge of Craig Wright's Copa case back then, to extract the data with these transactions in there and submit it as evidence in the Copa case. Now, Craig Wright claims that Alex Partners and Ontier had access to this data back in 2019 as part of the Kleinman case. But when Copa's counsel wrote to Ontier about this, Ontier denied this and said that they had only received the data on the 9th of March 2020 and not in 2019. Now, this led Mr. Hoff to question Wright over who was lying, and he said that Ontier have no reason to lie about this. And we nearly got an explanation from Craig Wright as to why Ontier might want to lie about him, but that was cut off right at the bit, right at the interesting bit, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, absolutely. This was, again, a case where, we can say a lot of things about Ontier, of course, but I still will accept that Ontier was not willingly defrauding the processes for the several courts that they have been representing Craig Wright, that they have been willingly being complicit in his... Of course, they passed along a lot of information that they should and could have known that it was fraudulent. That's where they did not do, in my opinion, not do enough due diligence. On the other hand, they were probably not willingly creating forgeries for him and helping him to make these forgeries believable in an unethical way. Now, so yeah, when Craig Wright is then saying that it's Ontier's fault that something happens, then of course it's not Ontier's fault. It's basically Craig Wright who has been defrauding within the processes, and in this case he had been entering backdated entries in MYOB, and then requested that Ontier would extract that information, create screenshots, etc., and hand it over.
So the interesting thing is that Patrick Madden looked at this initial data that was sent over, and he was the one that found these entries dated the 9th of March and backdated. And so Craig Wright, this was one of his replacements. He replaced that accounting data with new accounting data, which he called the correct version. But, and I'll quote from one of the COPA filings here what Patrick Madden found. Mr. Madden was able to detect that the new MYOB databases were actually created no earlier than May or June 2023 using software that was not released until mid-May 2023 and was not created until 10th of May 2023, and that the databases were backdated so as to seem contemporaneous to Satoshi Nakamoto's time. So on the face of it, that's no better, in fact worse, than the first lot of data. And what we learned is that Craig Wright seems to think it was Ramona, his wife, that gave Dr. Plax access to the live version of MYOB. And he extracted a file. He pretty much kind of extracted the database. He extracted a file from the raw data in there. And he found, well, but both the experts between them agreed that there was entries for 2010 were mixed up with entries from 2023. But the way that it was all done in a linear way, so it looked like, you know, these entries for 2010 were done at certain points in 2023. Now, Craig Wright's claim was that no, these entries were made in 2010, but these updated schemas made it look like they'd been made in 2023. It messed around with the time stamping of the things, and now his big point was that He sent the logins to the experts, but the experts didn't look at the live site. They took an extract of the data and looked at the extract. And his argument was that if they'd used the live site, they would have seen what he expected them to see. Whereas when they extracted it, it added those updated schemas and messed around with the dates. Now, my thinking with that was that they didn't make a mistake. They knew exactly what they were doing, and that they knew that by looking at the live site, it was how Craig Wright would want it to appear. But they knew that by extracting the data, they would see what actually happened.
But I think and suspect, but I don't know, I'm not an expert on MYOB, of course, which is the accounting software that Craig Wright used in Australia. And obviously, still in London, he has access to that environment in Australia, so he can still log on and create entries in it. I think, I'm actually pretty sure, knowing a little bit about databases and what gets updated when you do software updates, the entry date will not be updated by a schema. Of course, other dates will be updated, but if you know a little bit how a table in a database works, there will be several dates, either set automatically by the software, set automatically by the database management system, set by updates from either from the database management system or from the software that is using the database, etc. So there will be several dates in a table, but if you are talking about a manually entered entry date and the date that is manually entered by the user in which he wants on the balance sheet or on the profit and loss card, where he wants to see an entry back in a certain financial year or tax year or fiscal year or whatever they call it in all those accounting systems. Commercial year is used, so you can play around with a lot of dates in accounting software. But it is for me 100%, and that was a point that was also made in court by Copus Council, that of course, wherever you use a database in either a test environment or in the live environment, the entry date will never be updated under no circumstances. Otherwise, you have completely untrustable accounting software that is not behaving like it should be. So it that was actually a good point that the Council of COPA was making. I think it was Hof at that moment. And Craig Wright will be, of course, he will hear. Then we know now that next week will be the week of the forensic experts getting into a clash with each other, but there's not so much of a clash because they're actually agreeing a lot. I think 80-90% they agree with each other, so that it will be a beautiful to watch how Craig Wright will be left and right being grilled and torn apart about his forgeries. And yeah, one of the things that they will push back in his face will be the MIOP software, that the entry dates will not change based on schemas that are being updated with a software update.
Because there was a lot of complaints from him that the experts, that he said they've not used my software, they've not used my files. So it seemed like he was trying to push on them a lot of data, a lot of information, a lot of resources. And they were like, no thanks, we'll find it ourselves. Because the data he provided told the story he wanted it to tell. Whereas they knew if they went like through the back door almost to get what they wanted to get, they would get the real data. So he was trying to push them toward, you know, his version of events, but they are clever enough to have seen past that.
Yep.
So that was one thing we looked at. So the next thing was the Papanema emails. Craig Wright says that he asked the fabled Dennis Mayaka for a bunch of documents regarding Wright International Investments and Tulip Trading Limited, which, as those that have listened to our story will know, Dennis Mayaka allegedly helped found in 2011, or as we believe, buy in 2014, at least Tulip Trading anyway. And apparently, so Craig Wright asked Dennis Mayaka for all this information regarding these two companies to help prove his case. And Mr. Mayaka, through Papa, is it Papa.Nema or Papanema@gmail.com, allegedly, sent through two emails on September the 10th last year, containing invoices and two identical Timecoin white papers, all from the 2009 to 2012 era. So I'll go through what these files contained and what was found. So one invoice was dated 30th of July 2009 for Tulip Trading. And this was mentioned in one of the COPA filings before the case. And we did wonder how he was going to explain how Tulip Trading, which supposedly was founded in 2011, was able to send an invoice 2 years before it was formed. And Craig had a very simple explanation for this. Oh, he said, oh, Dennis Mayaka put the wrong year. And I just, like, he said that Dennis Mayaka has been working for me for 14 years. And like, how can you trust an accountant? How can you trust a lawyer who can't put the right year in an invoice? That's ridiculous for a start. And I think as well, they made a point that Dennis Mayaka had also in invoices or in certain documents throughout years afterwards consistently put the wrong year for these documents. And it's just, he really wants us to believe that as a serious businessman and a guy who's going to use Bitcoin to change the world, he relies and continues to rely on a lawyer who cannot get the year right. And also, as we discovered, as we said before, he consistently farms his blog posts, Twitter posts, Slack posts out to third parties, even though they continually screw him over and kind of hack into them and put misleading information. This is just another layer, isn't it, to this whole thing of he'll use any excuse to throw anybody under the bus, and he won't consider how that makes him look.
Yep. Yeah, but that is what why I'm... I mean, we know how he wheels and deals in with his Bitcoin fraud story. We know that already for so many years, so we are not so much surprised anymore. What I want to see, and what I expect and hope and expect to see, is that Justice Mueller will... he will probably write several paragraphs about it, because I expect a rather long ruling in hopefully a few weeks or months, but it might even take. In the meantime, I read a few stories about Mr. Mueller that when the case is a bit complicated, he can take almost a year before he comes to a ruling. But yeah, let's see how it goes in this case, because for me it's rather clear, and he can just take two paragraphs, a lot of forgeries, a lot of lies in court, because he did it over the course of this case. It is considered perverting the course of justice. So here, Mr. Wright, this is your punishment, and you're not Satoshi either. So I would be rather quickly done with it, but of course he has to consider a lot of things and he has to explain a lot of things. He has to explain what he thinks of each witness, etc., etc. So that will be quite a ruling. So that might be a little bit of a pocketbook of a ruling that he is going to produce in due time. But anyway, back to to where we were. These invoices, these forgeries that Dennis Mayaka created, not Dennis Mayaka, Craig Wright created them, of course. 2009 was indeed not possible. 2011 is also not possible because that was a moment when we know that the shelf company Tulip Trading was created in on the Seychelles, but not by Craig Wright, but by some company, Abacus, or what was the name?
Abacus, that was the name.
And only in 2014, we know that he bought that company. He requested an shelf company to set up what became later the Tulip Trust in October 2014. And yeah, it goes from one crazy story to the other because he has been he took, that is what we know from the other information from the Manor reports, he took invoices from 2014 that were the invoices being sent to him about buying Tulip Trading Limited on the Seychelles. And he took the PDF invoice and adjusted the text on the invoice. He saved it and made them look like 2009 and 2011. And then he blames, of course, Dennis Mayaka for the crazy dates.
Mm-hmm. So that was how he tried to explain the invoices. Now, we've got these two Timecoin white papers, which are supposed to be smoking guns, of course. Mm-hmm. Now, Craig Wright, under questioning, said it was very, very difficult to... even today, to write the Timecoin paper and backdate it and have it produced in the way it came out. And we'll come back to that. It's a very interesting point. We'll come back to that later on. Now, what Mr. Hoff put to him was that after having apparently tried to get hold of, as far as Craig Wright says, tried to get hold of Dennis Mayaka for 3 years for this information, he not only heard back from Dennis Mayaka right before the trial with the very documents he needed, but he found, or Dennis Mayaka sent him the Timecoin white paper within 5 days of him finding it on this drive at home. So having never mentioned it before, having never searched for it before, apparently, within 5 days, Dennis Mayaka gets hold of it and he gets hold of it at the same time. It's just, if one didn't work, he had to double down. He had to go belt and braces, didn't he, with the second one?
Yeah, they made a big point in it during the court session, as you might remember, that it was indeed unbelievable, inconceivable that indeed a rarity like a Timecoin paper that we never heard about before 2019, as some might remember, and yeah, that is another story that will come up in a bit. But the Timecoin paper is mentioned by one of his witnesses. Now, yeah, then we know already that cannot be true. But anyway, within 5 days exactly, and I think they checked it with the hash of those papers. It was exactly the same paper, the exactly same hash, and it was suddenly found by Craig Wright. And 5 days later, Dennis Mayaka came with exactly that same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so Craig Wright, based in London, finds this drive and finds the Timecoin white paper on it. And 5 days, I'm not sure which side it happened, but within 5 days of that, Dennis Mayaka, from his London time zone, sends the exact same document through to him, along with his dodgy invoices and no other documents to support the company. Bear in mind, he was supposed to have set these companies up. He didn't send any other documents about the company through apart from these documents. And Craig Wright put that down. He said, no, he's got lots of them. He just didn't send them through. Well, again, you've asked your lawyer for all this information and he sent you supposedly a grain of rice in a massive paddy field of information through. It's just utter nonsense.
Yeah, because he tried to make a lame excuse about it again, of course, because tulip trading had nothing to do with the Time Coin paper had nothing to do with the Abacus information that was actually requested from Danis. I think that was a bit of the debunk that
it was. It was a marketing paper. He put it down to E. He said the reason he had hold of it was because it was a marketing paper. And this was another funny thing, because Craig Wright was supposed to say that it was for Tripwire, one of his products, Tripwire. And so that's why Dennis Miakis still had hold of this old marketing document. It was a white paper. Yeah. But what was interesting for that one was that the Time Coin, was that this marketing Time Coin white paper included spelling mistakes that didn't appear in the Bitcoin white paper.
They compared the Bitcoin white paper with the Time Coin white paper, and they noticed that several parts of the Bitcoin white paper without any spelling mistakes were one-on-one coming back in the Time Coin white paper, and the parts that were written, either rewritten or added to the Time Coin white paper to give it the appearance of a completely different white paper, that contained several spelling mistakes. I remember they mentioned some, but I don't recall which ones. About a handful, indeed. The spelling mistakes were only in the parts that were added to make it look like a Time Coin white paper. So the Bitcoin white paper parts were still perfectly written without any spelling mistakes, but the Time Coin unique paragraphs contained the spelling mistakes. And then of course Craig came with another lame excuse that he is always using in this type of things, that he has several versions of documents. I remember that he even had a recent paper that he was working on. He said, I have like 25 different versions of the document, and then I'm like, but Please, how can you believe such a thing that you, when you work on a paper, you have 25 different versions, you don't do any versioning on those documents, you just pick a random one and you start writing on it, you save it again, and then you the next day you pick another of those 20, and then you start working on that one, and that's how you make a random mess of your papers. I mean, that is not organized. And if you have to produce, like he says that he is producing, like 3 patents a week and whatever, then this is not the way how you do that. When he is, it's also something, it's unbelievable that he puts a document on a server, on a network, where his staff can have access to the document, and instead of making that document read-only, for the staff to read and learn from those documents, if needed, and then send in proposals for changes in the text to him in a separate document or in an email or during a meeting face to face, and then suggest changes in that read only document, and then Craig Wright will make those changes because he is the only one with edit access to that document. That is how you work properly on a network with a staff that is also trying to influence a document. Giving the whole company edit access to a document is, of course, asking for trouble. Now, I mean, he is the IT security guy. He should know better, right?
Well, I think this is the point I made recently, is that he makes all these claims, he shows off his certificates and things, but then he says things to purely to get himself out of a hole that he's dug himself into, which undermine his IT credentials. So you can't have it both ways. Are you an IT security genius and you have everything locked down and no one can get into your systems and everything is foolproof and whatever? Or are you so ramshackle that, as you say, you leave documents on servers, you leave documents on different laptops that can be compromised, you are hacked by God knows who every few years, you don't check your documents that are sent there before you send them off to the ATO. It's just, which is it? You can't have it both ways. And unfortunately, he so far, he's largely got away with it because the people that need to believe him do believe him. But he's now coming up against people who hopefully have a more critical view and can see, well, either this or this. You can't mix them both together to suit your argument. It doesn't work that way.
No.
So on to what for many was the sort of the really big thing in this Friday evidence. That was the LaTeX discussion. And I saw someone on BSV call this the magic bullet that was going to win the case for Craig. Now, again, this really got into some technical things that were way over my head. So I'm going to let you take the lead on this one, Arthur, and just sort of talk us through what was discussed between Mr. Gunning and Craig Wright and what the sort of the main arguments were. Because and if you can make it, if you can break it down for regular people, shall we say, that would be very much appreciated.
I want to keep that story indeed a bit high level, because in the details it's indeed a bit of a mess. But initially he created a metadata dump of that stuff that could be checked, and they already found, of course, flaws and discrepancies in that part already. But of course, they wanted to see the real deal also. So I think it was in December, just before Christmas, by head, that Justice Mellers ruled that Team Copa should have access to both the online Overleaf website and the platform where he was keeping those files, and also the drives where they where Craig Wright said that those files were found. There were two hard drives, a BDO drive and another Samsung drive, I think. And what they figured out was that the Overleaf environment, the online environment where Craig kept and hosted and was fooling around with those LaTeX with that LaTeX stuff, Overleaf, it was that account was set up in August 2023. Now, from there, he has been doing a lot of things, and the highlight was how he created the white paper in LaTeX. Because his story is that the original white paper was created with LaTeX, not with OpenOffice. And from there, he made an export or a dump or save as action. And then it was the PDF was created that, it was merged or copied to OpenOffice. And from there, it was saved. And that was the version that was released in I think the first version was released in October, and the second version was released in March 2009, and that is the version that we can still download. It has never been changed since then. But between October 2008 and March 2009, I think he added a few things and corrected one or two typos or something. No big changes, but anyway, Craig's story is that LaTeX was the original one, so it is dated before October, supposedly. And that means that if he created an Overleaf account in August 2023, that is, of course, a big gap in how that is possible. So to cut a long story short, what they found out is that the white paper was, instead of being created first and then the OpenOffice version was created, it has been done the other way around. Craig Wright took the Bitcoin white paper created in OpenOffice, and with all those LaTeX tools available on Overleaf, and I think he also used another website, they were... Craig Wright used that to edit and correct the OpenOffice version to sort of overhaul that open office white paper to a LaTeX white paper. He was hoping that, because LaTeX is somewhat famous for not having too much metadata, that he could create a unique piece of evidence that would, yeah, prove to the outside world and to the court that he was having a unique version of the white paper dated before the open office white paper from October. Now, what happened? They found out that indeed the metadata, However, the moment they logged on to this Overleaf environment, they figured that Overleaf was having backups of the logs of what Craig Wright has been doing in that environment since August. And the highlight was around November, halfway November, between 15 and 20 by head of November, that he has he had indeed uploaded the open office white paper, and he tried to recreate that in the LaTeX white paper. I'm imagining what happened is that Bird and Bird, which is the council of, maybe not Bird and Bird even, it could also be the Bitcoin developers council who has been doing that, because they, in the end, they created an animation, time-lapse animation. And they probably subpoenaed the Overleaf management administrators to get access to information of every keystroke, literally every keystroke that Craig Wright has been doing on the Overleaf website. And then they got a dump of every keystroke that he had been doing on that website. And they could recreate the exact moments, the exact times, the exact seconds and milliseconds and nanoseconds what he had been doing with that white paper. So they figured out that, and I'm saying 15 to 20, but it was, or 17 to 20, I'm just doing it quickly by head.
Wow.
Of November 2023, and they created a beautiful animation, a time lapse, where they put the Bitcoin white paper, I think in red, on top of the in white the thing that Craig Wright was creating, and then all the pages of the white paper, four on top or five, and the other pages on the row below that, and you could beautifully see that he started on page one, then he went to page two, then he went to page three, and then he went back to page two, etc. You could really see what he had been adjusting on that white paper to recreate it in LaTeX and make it look like exactly the same layout and fonts and things as the Bitcoin white paper. Because if you do a quick conversion, a lot of things mess up and will not look properly and etc. in LaTeX if you do a quick conversion. So he had to do a lot of manual adjustments. And you could also see beautifully that he had been trying out a lot of things while converting, well, manually editing the open office white paper and to recreate it in LaTeX, that he was fooling around and that he was like a noob, like an amateur who has not very experienced in LaTeX yet. That he had been trying out several things, settings, spaces between words, the millimeters between them, and images, the quality of images, how to recreate that and make it look properly, etc. Now, a lot of things that, that made it so perfectly clear that he was just creating a forgery there, because that same thing ended up as the file that was sent to COPPA, or was put on the drive in the first place, and then sent to COPPA as this is genuine 2008 LaTeX file.
Because didn't they mention a tool called Aspos or something along those lines that they think he used to take the PDF and convert it back into a LaTeX file because it was so precise. It mirrored what you would get if you did that. So he either used this tool to convert the PDF into the LaTeX file and then claim that was the real, and tweak it and claim that was the real thing, or he manually sat with a version of the Bitcoin white paper and a blank LaTeX file and just copied one by one, piece for piece, and moved things around. But I seem to remember there was the talk about this ASPOS tool, which seems to be the method he used to do that, isn't it?
That is basically how it went, yeah. But I did not figure out if he indeed opened OpenOffice on one screen or in the left or right half of the screen, and then did like a Control A, Control C, Control V action. Or sometimes you have also, of course, you can convert and just upload a document, and then the software or the app, the tool, what you're working with will automatically try to convert as best as possible to convert the document into a readable format in the other tool that you're working with.
Wasn't his argument that the reason he made all those changes was because he was demonstrating for shoesmiths how small changes can make big differences? That was what he said, wasn't it? He wasn't creating the fake file. He was deconstructing the white paper to show shoesmiths how it could be done.
That was indeed his excuse, but that excuse made totally no sense, because from that from the log files from Overleaf, they found out that he had been working for a total of 22 hours to create that forgery. A little over 22 hours working, real working hours. But that was divided over 3 or 4 days, if I remember well. And there was even a day that he has been working 10 hours in a row, or with maybe a break here and there. But the only contact that he had with shoesmith during that period of time, during that little time frame of several days, was at the end when he and that was they did it rather nicely. They gave a red flash in the time lapse. the animation started to flash one or two times quickly in red, and that was the signal that that's where Craig Wright was having a teleconference with shoesmith. Now, can you imagine that personnel, lawyers of shoesmith, his counsel, are visiting him at his house, because I think that was also a part of his excuse.
He said that.
That they were at his house. Can you imagine that Craig Wright, he wakes up, he finds a shoesmith lawyer in his home office, and they together, they sit down for 3 days, for 22 hours in a row, and he is explaining shoesmith that this is how it works when you recreate a LaTeX file from OpenOffice. And this is not what I've been doing. No. Nou ja, the funny thing is, he has been doing that, and that file ended up on the drives that were provided to Copa.
Well, of course, we know how they got there, because Craig Wright claimed on the stand that any files that he agreed were manipulated, because he could find no way to excuse them, had been planted famously by Christian Agger Hansen. So, yeah, we had a repeat of that excuse, which, again, we said in the last episode, is just not going to wash without any evidence. And actually, on the subject of evidence, there was a stark contrast between Craig Wright's witnesses who made these claims of having received white papers and having had him run nodes on their laptops in the Bitcoin's early days, all these sorts of stories mentioning transaction timestamp servers, this sort of thing back in the day. None of them came with any written evidence. And yet, as we'll see, two of Copa's key witnesses, Marty Malmy and Adam Back, had written evidence, undisclosed emails from those early Satoshi days to back up their claims. And that is the kind of thing that a judge is going to take much more notice of than just hearsay.
Yeah, exactly.
So overall then, what's interesting with these LaTeX files is that they were presented as the smoking gun, and his supporters got very excited about what they represented. But he seems to have placed a bit less reliance on the LaTeX documents after they were analysed for various reasons. He's really come to not rely on them as much as he was back then. And in fact, it's gone from being a smoking gun to just being a Hail Mary, but a Hail Mary that totally failed to land, isn't it?
Yeah, that's how I would summarise it also, yeah.
Those are the main highlights from his testimony on Friday, but just one or two things to note from the day itself. It was interesting how Mr. Hoff, I think because he knew he only had the morning to get through his questions, he was really cutting Craig Wright off. He wasn't putting up with any of his waffle. He was just getting straight to the point. And if Craig Wright was rattling on too much, he would just jump in and say, go to the next exhibit number. And I kind of wish he was like that from the off, because they're spending the time listening to Craig Wright banging on and repeating the same things, shouting in all caps. It just got too much by the end, and I think if they'd have taken that approach a bit earlier, they might have actually reduced the amount of ranting he could do.
Yeah, true. You noticed that that Hoff was growing in his role, and it took a few days to get him properly aligned with the atmosphere in the courtroom. That was noticeable. Yeah.
True. And also, did you notice Justice Meller not just asking questions, but jumping in and being quite critical? There's quite a few times when he said to just answer the question. And then other times, like when it came to like a date stamp time, the time zone issue with the 1 hour either way, he was really pushing right on these questions, wasn't he? So I think he was also trying to get as much out of him on that last day that he could. But he came across as quite almost confrontational at times, didn't he, on Friday?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember for me a rather notable moment was when Meller was three times, and I think it was related to that LaTeX Files story, that he asked, I think it was, he was asking about the right order of things happening, and why did Craig Wright not provide the original file from the start, but the end file with the flaws, something like that. And Meller was indeed putting it to him, literally, that he had been recreating that file.
Yes, I remember now, yeah.
He was in another emotional state as previously, because I also remember Meller as making jokes with Hoff, but also with Lord Grabener, and making little jokes and being a light-hearted, good-hearted judge dealing with this case. But now you got him, what I would say what I had perceived as being a little bit angry. Agitated.
Yeah, he was. He was verging on that because he wasn't getting the answers that he wanted. He wanted straightforward answers, and he wasn't getting them. And he was just trying to get these answers from Craig Wright that he just wasn't getting. So it was fair enough that he was getting that agitated. So that was everything that we learned from Craig Wright on Friday, and that brought us to the end of the week. So going back to the start of the week then, we had a range of witnesses. We had Stephen Matthews, Adam Back, Marty Malmy, Mike Hearn. We had a bunch of characters that came across. Some were more interesting, some were more revelatory, some provided more interesting features of the Satoshi story than others, which is no fault of their own because some are more deeply connected than others are. But Arthur, what were your highlights from the batch of witnesses we got at the start? What were your highlights, and what were you sort of more disappointed with as far as the early witnesses went?
Again, I did not watch everything because I remember, especially in the first half of the week, I had to do several other things, so to say. I had other obligations. So my plugging in on the live stream was a bit ad hoc here and there. But I remember that in the afternoon, Stephen Matthews was there. In general, Stephen Matthews, we basically know his story, of course, from the Hodlnot in Oslo, Norway. There was also a trial where he attended and live, just like in London now, he was also live in the courtroom. And so, yeah, we know his story. But what was peculiar, in the meantime, a few details changed in Craig Wright's story, what happened back in 2007 and 8 and 9. And so we were all curious, has Stephen Matthews been updated about these changes? And did he follow? Well, he did not follow. for example, one of the, I think one of the details was that now that the Timecoin white paper is something, new in the whole thing. Actually, he created, if I remember well, he created that forgery already in 2019, and that's why the moment that the name Timecoin comes up, we know, oh yeah, that's something from 2019 and onward. That did not happen in 2009 or earlier. But anyway, that is how Craig Wright now wants it to be. And at some point, I'm doing this by head, but if I remember well, he also said that it was not the Bitcoin white paper that Stephen Matthews received, but the Timecoin white paper that he received. And so I was like, okay, will Stephen Matthews mention Timecoin? No, he still mentioned Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was, and there were several of those discrepancies to be noted.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed by the Stephen Matthews testimony. I mean, I'm not sure what I was expecting, but they really drilled down hard into details over the signing sessions, which was interesting, and I'm sure they had a point to it, but without having seen his witness testimony for this trial, and we don't know if it's different from the others, we don't really know what the point was. So I was waiting for a couple of bombshells, and there were a couple, but nothing too spectacular, to be honest. So a little bit underwhelming as far as that goes. We then flipped, and we had the COPA witnesses taking the stand from the afternoon, starting with Steve Lee, who was something to do with Spiral, some sort of non-profit part of Block, which was that was a complete waste of time, that one. And so we'll jump straight to Wednesday, where we had Marty Melmy on the stands, didn't we?
Yeah, Marty Melmy and Adam Beck. No, that was for me, next to Friday, for me, the highlight. That was the article that I published today, which is, again, going viral, really going viral. What was interesting about that day, and now that I have been able to look at, they were not available before, but now that the witness statements, and both of them, Marty Melmy and Adam Beck, both were asked to deliver two witness statements. One, to give their history within Bitcoin and their connection to Satoshi Nakamoto. And the second witness statement, which was in both cases asked from them several months after the first witness statement, that went deeper into several statements that Craig Wright had been making over the course of time between the first of their witness statements and later on in the process, and then we are talking roughly in 2023. Let's say the first half of the year until, and then the second witness statements were later in the second half of the year, so like 3 to 6 months later. Then the witness statements of Craig Wright became known, and in several witness statements, Craig Wright mentioned Adam Beck and Marty Melmy, and he noted down peculiar anecdotes, so to say. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that has to be debunked, of course, by Marty Melmy and Adam Beck. Now, and that was where the second witness statements were about. Now, then you can look at the cross examination. Mm-hmm. One of the things that immediately became clear, almost from from the first within minutes, when Marty Melmy was asked by the counsel of Craig Wright, what was the first contact that you had with Satoshi Nakamoto? Mm-hmm. Now, that was the 1st of May of 2009. So that was 4 months after go live of Bitcoin. as we all know. Mm-hmm. The 3rd of January was the go live. So the 1st of May is exactly 4 months later. However, Craig Wright had said in his witness statement that he already was in touch with Marty Malmi in February 2009. Now, that were, and so the in cross, Craig's counsel is trying to twist, sort of, question Marty Malmi. Is it possible? Is your memory good? Have you maybe contacted him on another platform, or was it on, etc., etc.? But yeah, Marty Malmi just stick to his story, and no, it just did not happen. I was living in that house. I was moving to another house, and he remembered it was in May. Then he said it was seriously only in April, late April, that I learned about Bitcoin. I studied it for several days. And I noticed that I felt comfortable with Bitcoin. I understand it for a bit. I wrote about it on another platform. What we understood is that Satoshi also wrote something on that other platform. Some, I don't know, state, independent state, well, I don't know, some .com website where Marty Malmi was writing in public on a forum, and Satoshi also was saying something, not directly to Marty Malmi at that moment, but Marty Malmi picked up that Satoshi was doing something with Bitcoin, so he went out to check what Bitcoin was. He studied for a few days and he was like, oh, I'm gonna contact Satoshi Nakamoto and maybe I can help him. Mm-hmm. Now, and that first email was the 1st of May 2009. Seriously, not in February. Mm-hmm. So that, and now, and we have now, I think, around two handfuls of debunks from the same order, where you can just say, yeah, because Craig Wright did not have access to the emails between Satoshi and Marty Malmi, because they have never been published anywhere, and there are quite a lot. There are more than there are actually 260 emails.
Okay.
They have now become public, and you can make all kinds of checks and cross checks with either Satoshi himself in public. We can cross check with what Craig Wright has been saying over the years with regards to Marty Malmi and what Satoshi has been doing, etc. Yeah, and then you can, just take again. They are all highlighted in my in my article, so go read it. Is my advice, and yeah, because it didn't stop there with the 1st of May. There were several other things. Just by head, the word cryptocurrency. Craig Wright has been stating that he never ever used the word cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. Now, in the emails from Marty Malmi, you can see them discussing the word cryptocurrency, where not Marty Malmi is bringing it up. It's Satoshi himself who read it somewhere and brought it up to Marty Malmi. Hey, this is looking nice. This is a nice word. I like it. Do you like it also? Something like that. Mm-hmm. He is asking Marty Malmi, and Marty Malmi is responding, yes, sounds good. Then a marketing text including the word cryptocurrency, where Craig Wright said, yeah, I didn't make that marketing text for the next release of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. That was Marty Malmi creating it. Now, from the emails and from Marty Malmi just clearly and firmly stating, no, I did not create that text. That was not my role. I did other things on the website. I did not make the announcements of new releases. I only did the frequently asked questions. I did this and that, and the admin, some technical things, the Linux version, now all kinds of things, but not the marketing text for new releases. That was Satoshi's role.
So
that there were all kinds of debunks going on in that cross. Mm-hmm. But because and that was also something that you could notice, not only with Marty Malmi, but later with Adam Back. He was the second that day. you just looked at people who are just being honest. Mm-hmm. They have nothing to lose. They have nothing to gain. They just tell from the memory with all the evidence available, which is in their cases, all the communications with the real Satoshi. And they just don't have anything to lie about. They just tell what happened. They're just honest people saying how they feel, how they think and reflect on what happened back then, and because they have been in touch with Satoshi, and they can prove that with emails. And in both cases, Marty and Adam, both their emails have never been released.
Yep.
Yeah, and now they have, and we can cross check with Craig Wright's stories, and there are quite a few flaws, discrepancies, and what we can label as lies. That Craig Wright has been telling.
Well, two things. Firstly, it will be interesting to see now, with these emails being public, how Craig Wright changes his story going forward, because I bet you there'll be details he changes to fit in with these early emails. So we may not see them very easily, but it'll be interesting to see if those do crop up. And secondly, I was watching, there wasn't a great deal from the Zuko Wilcox O'Hearn interview that really stuck out to me, but on the subject of what you're saying about people just having recollections, being honest, and they come across as really honest people with nothing to hide. He said, yeah. The prosecutor against him said, you received coins from Satoshi, didn't you? He said, no. He said, you did. I put it to you. You received the coins from Satoshi. He said, no, I would know. He was my hero. I would know if Satoshi sent me coins. And it's such an obvious thing. Of course he would. If he really held him in that high regard, of course he'd remember if Satoshi sent him his Bitcoin. And it's kind of, I know that he's got to do it, but to say, well, no, I put it to you that you didn't. It's just such a weak argument. And you can tell it's just... Yeah. Going, he's doing his job, but that was a pretty tame effort as far as I was concerned.
What I found so that was like I had to smile when I heard it, that when Zuko was saying, yeah, but I didn't even have a Windows machine to run Bitcoin on, so it wasn't even technically possible for me. So yeah, beautiful.
So, Arthur, was there anything particular in Adam Back's testimony that you thought was like sort of stood out or could be quite damaging for Craig?
Oh yeah, many, many things, both on the practical side of emails and on the technical side. But I will refer to my article that I released today. Mm-hmm. There is where where I put in a really nice detailed description of a debunk, and on Friday Craig Wright doubled down and was debunked again.
Yeah, of course. But, standard. Yeah,
oh man, crazy. Nay, but let's keep it to the emails, for example. There was only five emails between Adam and Satoshi. They only exchanged five times a message. Three times from Satoshi to Adam, and two times from Adam back to Satoshi. Mm-hmm. Now, Craig Wright has been creating several other stories around Adam Back. For example, Adam Back was supposed to have told Craig Wright, Satoshi, that it would not work, or it was unstable or something, and Adam Back expected that Bitcoin would not succeed in a technical sense. Now, and Adam Back says, no. Mm-hmm. Those email exchanges do not exist. This is all I have, and this is all that we have been exchanging all this time. Now, we have such an example also with Vaidai, mm-hmm. if you might remember. Of course, Vaidai is not a party or a witness in this case, but not that long ago, I talked with Vaidai. Because Craig Wright has been stating also several things that he already had contact with Vaidai in May of 2008. And Vaidai says, nope, did not happen. The 22nd of August was the first time that I heard from Satoshi Nakamoto. And now this is a nice fun fact to know. We only had the Vaidai emails as being the early contacts of Satoshi with somebody else, that the name of Satoshi Nakamoto was presented, was used. But now Adam Back, his contact with Satoshi was 2 days earlier, August the 20th. So that is now the oldest known email, the oldest known document where we find the name Satoshi Nakamoto. Now, that is a nice fun fact that we have reached in this case. Now, yeah, and just like with Wydai, Adam Back also had several of those debunks. And he could prove it with the genuine emails that he exchanged with the real Satoshi Nakamoto.
So the funny thing is, we did have bombshell evidence this week, just not from Craig Wright.
Exactly.
Now, the last witness we'll discuss is Howard Hinnant, who was the co-creator of the Chrono language in C++. Now, this is a little bit over my head, but even I was able to understand the ludicrousness of this situation. So in simple terms, Craig Wright submitted evidence that he wrote code for Bitcoin using the standard Chrono library, but it was discovered that this wasn't launched until 2011. So Craig Wright changed his story to say that he was actually using a different library called Project Chrono. But Mr. Hinnant, among others, noted that this was a completely unrelated library for physics simulations that uses totally different function and variable names than the standard Chrono that Wright had said he initially used. But Craig Wright claimed that he wrapped the Project Chrono libraries inside his own custom library, which he decided to insert into the standard Chrono namespace, which apparently is something that real C++ coders just would never do, as well as implementing functions that, surprise, surprise, just so happens to use the exact same function and variable names as the standard Chrono libraries. He just happened to make something that looked exactly like Chrono years before. Now, Mr. Hinnant was asked to explain the likelihood of getting to Project Chrono from Chrono, and he described it, and I don't think I'm ever going to forget this, he described it as starting out with a P-51 Mustang fighter jet and tweaking it and changing it until you got a Ford Mustang car. And he argued, and this is a direct quote that I found, he said this would be technically so outrageous that it's literally unbelievable. And he also suggested that the very idea of someone saying they did this shows they did not have the technical understanding to even attempt it. So this in itself was brilliant. But what I liked about this was that a lot of the BSV crowd said, oh, wow, Craig's proved he can do this impossible thing. Isn't he a genius? And yet when he was challenged on the ease with which anybody could have taken a PDF of the Bitcoin white paper and converted it using ASPOS or whatever tool it might have been into a LaTeX document, he went on for ages about how difficult it was. So again, which is it? Are you a genius who can do all these things, or are these things so impossible that no one could do them? You can't have them both.
Yeah.
So that caps the whole of this week's testimony from both the witnesses and from Craig Wright himself. Now, next week, we have what might actually prove to be more important and more defining for the case than Craig Wright's testimony, or at least equal parity with it. The forensics experts are going to be on the stand. And the reason why this has become so important is that Craig Wright has challenged the authenticity, challenged the bias, challenged the competency of all the experts that have been court approved and that were not challenged by his lawyers. And it's going to be up to his barristers to prove his claim. And the reason why that is so important is if his barristers can back up his claims that these experts are not to be trusted, that's going to massively weigh in his favour. So I think he's put, I could be making this up, but it seems to me he's put more pressure on his barristers to undermine the experts than they normally would have done. Do you think that's a fair comment?
Yeah, that is absolutely fair. But it means that the dilemma that his counsel will have is that they have to defend the nonsense, the all the weird explanations from hacking and third-party laptops that has been floating around. Citrix that has been doing things that the normal Citrix metaframe environment will never do, only in spectacularly rare situations, and certainly not in the ordered way where Craig Wright is claiming that pieces of text end up in other documents, from one document to the other document, and land on the exact spot where they were supposed to be to make a coherent document again. That means that they have to reuse the narrative in all the things that has been thrown at Craig Wright, and that is a lot. I mean, we're talking about dozens and dozens and dozens of forgeries, things that he had all kinds of weird explanations for, but never any evidence. And that is the whole point. So they have to, his counsel now has to try make the narrative without evidence weigh up against the evidence in the Madden reports that are supported by the experts on both sides. Now that is an uphill battle from here to Tokyo that I don't see that is not going to be a successful element of the case for Craig Wright. That is what I think beforehand.
It's going to be really interesting to see how they handle these forensics experts. Like you say, there's a lot riding on this, and I think he's made their job a lot harder in some respects. So just to give a brief outline of the timeline then, on Monday morning we have Patrick Madden, well actually for the whole of Monday, we have Patrick Madden cross-examined the whole of Monday. We have Craig Wright's forensics expert, Dr. Plax, cross-examined on Tuesday morning. We have Mr. Lynch, who I think is for Craig Wright as well, on Tuesday afternoon. Mr. Rosendahl, I think he might be for COPA, on Wednesday morning. Then that's it for the forensics experts. Then we have the cryptocurrency experts on Wednesday afternoon, which is going to be interesting but not particularly vital to the case. Thursday morning, there's no sitting. And the last action before the closing arguments the week afterwards is going to be Bjarne Stroustrup being cross-examined on Thursday afternoon. So that's how next week breaks down. So what are you looking forward to most next week?
The first half of the week. That is, of course, my thing. The forgeries. Mm-hmm. And especially what I just said already, that uphill battle of Craig's counsel trying to translate Craig's narrative, which is, so to say, a lot of bullshit and nonsense, try to make that believable in front of the judge against both Craig's own forensic experts and of course, COPA's forensic experts.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. I hope it doesn't get too technical. I fear it might, but I also think there's going to be plenty of nuggets we can dig out and polish up and dissect to our heart's content. Now, one thing that's worth mentioning here is that, as some listeners may know, there have been a clutch of 10, maybe even 12 witness statements released by COPA relating to individuals who are not going to be challenged on the stand. Now, we had hoped to bring you a breakdown of these today, but given time constraints, that's not going to be possible. So what we're going to do is, next week, Arthur and I are going to go through these witness statements and pick out what the really interesting key parts are from them and explain the relevance they could have, given that the judge will be accepting these as fact, more or less. So those will be available as a special bonus episode coming next week. Our Dr. Bitcoin subscribers will get that a few days early as a thank you. So if you want to get that bonus episode a few days early, head to www.drbitcoinpod.com/supporters-club to find out how to do that. Arthur, thank you so much for your time today. I will see you for the bonus episode, and then again this time next week, where we'll discuss the last week's worth of evidence.
Yes, sir. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on your podcast platform of choice to get these episodes the moment they drop. And if you enjoyed what you heard, we'd really appreciate a star rating and even a review to help us get this out to as many people as possible. Our monthly bonus episodes are available to download from our website for a small consideration. And if you'd like to access all these bonus episodes, plus these monthly updates a few days early and other goodies, you can do so by becoming a Dr. Bitcoin supporter. See the details in the show notes for information on how to do this, or head to our website, drbitcoinpod.com. That's drbitcoinpod.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at drbitcoinpod, and you can email us at drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. That's drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll speak to you again soon.
You've been listening to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. Written by Mark Hunter, with additional material by Arthur Van Pelt. Editing and production by Mark Hunter. This has been a Contented Media production.